Welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Zayani Bhatt, personal finance writer at Investors Chronicle, and Carl Harald Jansen, co-manager of International Biotechnology Trust. Carl, what kind of biotechnologies does International Biotechnology Trust invest in, and why should investors consider having an allocation to them?
Thank you, Leonora, for inviting me, and I'll try to give a short answer to this first question. So what we invest in the International Biotechnology Trust are mainly companies or stocks in companies that develop drugs or have drugs approved on the various markets in the world. So this will be, you know, drugs for serious diseases, various types. We also have some medtech investments, and we invest in large cap names. So we have 40% in large cap names, more than $10 billion. We have 40% in mid-cap names, between $1 and $10 billion, and 25% in small-cap names. So it's kind of a diversified portfolio, and most of them are located in the U.S., so with 90% U.S. investments and 10% European investments. And we also have another cut, and that is that we invest in quoted stocks mostly. You know, 90% of the trust is invested in listed equities, and 10% is unquoted investments. The second part of the question, by the way, is, you know, why should you invest in the sector? Mm-hmm. And I think the main reason is, in my view anyway, that historically this sector has performed better than the general stock market. So the biotech sector has delivered 10% per year of growth in the last 20 years, while, you know, the broader stock market only has delivered 5%. So this sector outgrows the general stock market. So it might be good, you know, to allocate to this sector if you think the future is going to repeat itself.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you have a mixture of listed and unlisted companies. So starting with the listed companies, I mean, how do you select the ones you're going to invest in? I mean, what kind of attributes do you want to see in a company that you're going to put in the investment trust portfolio?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question, and that we spend a lot of time on. And I think over the years, I've done this almost 20 years, so I've kind of distilled down, you know, a few factors that are maybe more important than others. First of all, I think it's important to think about, you know, the balanced portfolio, to see that you have, you know, within the portfolio good balance of various stocks. But when you think about a particular stock, we think that if you develop a new drug, or you have a drug on the market, it should be a drug that meets a serious medical need. It shouldn't just be another pill for headaches. It should be something that is important, that does something for seriously ill people, you know, prolonging life or reducing handicap and so on. It should also be a drug that is protected from, you know, patent expiry and has a regulatory protection, so that you can earn back your money that you have invested. And thirdly, I think it's important to see that the companies have a good financing, you know, so that they can develop the drugs and so on. The financial risk is very important. And also competition is important, so that you don't, you know, other drugs that might compete with this particular drug, you know, that you can actually defend your market. And lastly, but not least, I would say the management of the company is very important. Maybe half the value, I don't know, half is, you know, it's an average number, but they say a big part of what I think about is who runs this company. So we have a very, very serious and close contacts with the company. So we try to speak a lot with the management at investment conferences, or when they come and visit us, or we have telephone conversations and so on, to keep track of what everyone is doing, you know, and try to be on top of the markets.
Okay, so what would be examples of these kinds of companies that you've got in the portfolio? Perhaps one or two.
Yeah, okay, that can speak to the length. Yeah. So maybe to be brief, there I think we have three areas where we have, you know, focus our investments. It's cancer companies with drugs against cancer, companies with drugs within the so-called orphan or rare disease space, so there are, you know, very few patients having every disease, and thirdly also for the neurological types of diseases. So for oncology and cancer, I would say, you know, the large cap names that we have is Incyte, that has Jakafi and Celgene, and now acquired by Bristol Myers, with Revlimid in the neurology space. You know, we like Neurocrine. It's one of the top 10 in the portfolio. And in the orphan space, I would say Vertex is a good, strong name that has developed a drug for cystic fibrosis.
Okay, now we're talking obviously about your existing companies, but thinking in terms of like, you know, possible new additions, what areas are you finding particularly good opportunities at the moment?
Yeah, I think the largest area with the opportunities is cancer and oncology for you know, and the main reason I think is that we have recently had, you know, very strong development in understanding cancer diseases, so that we are better, we can deliver better drugs for cancer patients. And cancer is also it's like, you know, not one disease, it's like 100 different diseases, so each one would need its own drug, and that creates its new a market by itself. And then there could be, you know, resistant development, and then you would have a second line treatment and third line treatment. So there are many opportunities, and we are currently, you know, understanding more and more about cancer. So we are developing new effective drugs.
Okay. Now, you also invest in a biotech fund, SV Fund 6. What are your reasons for doing this? And is investing in a fund more expensive than investing directly in investments? Because obviously funds charge fees.
Of course. This is, you know, a legacy thing that we still do, and we think it's very important to continue to do. So the trust has existed for 25 years. And over this time, it has invested in unquoted companies too. So when I arrived as a fund manager in 2013, we had about 15% in unquoted investments. That was stopped, and instead now we do invest in a venture fund. It's much, you know, more efficacious, and I think it diversifies the risk. So we hold 5 to 15% in unquoted. That's kind of what the board has said, and today we have 7+% in this venture fund that has 21 underlying holdings. So investors that invest in this trust would also be exposed to a venture fund. I think that is kind of a good thing. It diversifies the risk in the portfolio, and also gives you access to an area that is difficult to get an access to. And actually, it contributes to the return also. This venture fund has already, you know, is at 1.3x return, you know, since we started 2.5 years ago. So that's why I think it's an answer.
Yeah. So what does the fund invest in?
Oh, the fund invests in today. We have, if my memory doesn't fool me here, 21 investments, and they are spread in three areas. So one area is biotech, so meaning kind of early stage drug development companies mostly. And the second area is what we call service or private equity. It would be more companies that service in the healthcare space. They usually have a, you know, quicker to revenues and earnings, and a quicker, you know, turnover time in the fund. And the third area is medicinal technology, where we have a few investments too.
Okay, and who runs the fund?
The fund is run by SV Health Investors, the
so,
organization.
So your company,
that yeah, exactly.
And so about is it yourself who runs the fund?
No, it's not. It's this is the venture part. So we're completely separate. I, in the sense of running the funds, I'm only run the investment trust. And on fees, that you asked the question about fees, there is no like a double layering of fees. Okay. The fee for the International Biotechnology Trust is 0.9%. Of the net asset value, and then we have an incentive fee on top of that for the quoted part of the portfolio.
Okay, actually, talking of the performance fee, how does this work? And you know, how can you justify having a performance fee at a time when many investment trusts are actually scrapping their performance fees?
Yeah, we have a performance fee on the quoted side of the portfolio. That's 90% of the portfolio. And that fee works in the way that it is 10% of the relative outperformance above the pound sterling adjusted Nasdaq Biotech Index. So that's comparator index plus 0.5% hurdle. And the fee on the unquoted pool remains 20% of net realized gains, taking into account any unrealized losses, but not unrealized gains. So we have have these two different sets of incentive fees, but that's not on the fund. So that's only kind of legacy unquoted holdings. And your question about other scrapping, I don't know. I haven't seen too many others scrapping their fees. On the contrary, we have seen investors come into our fund, and we used to have a discount. Now we actually have a premium, issue new shares. So someone likes the trust, I think.
You mentioned that the fund used to invest directly in quoted. Now you've very much focused this area on SV Fund 6. But do you have any direct investments still in unquoted investments?
Yes. So when we stopped investing in the unquoted, the direct investments a few years ago, then we kind of decided that we need to continue to support the various companies we already invested in. So you could consider that a runoff portfolio, where we now have eight direct investments as end of March, constituting 2.4% of the trust. And then we also have five investments that have already been exited in the unquoted side, but where we have contingent milestones, meaning that sometimes in the future there might be a sales milestone or something, and that constitutes 2.6% of the trust. But those two, 2.4 and 2.6, about 5%, are coming down each year, and a few years from now will be zero, and instead we'll have just one venture fund or maybe another venture fund in the future in order to diversify out the trust into also the unquoted area. So in total, we have 78 holdings. We have 64 quoted stocks at the end of March. We have one fund investment with 22 underlying investments and 13 direct unquoted. So it's pretty much a diversified portfolio.
Okay, now you mentioned earlier your assets are very focused on North America, and according to your March fact sheet, that was 87% invested in that area. I think the issue is the US, where I presume most of these are, is believed to be a really expensive market. So doesn't this mean the trust holdings are A, expensive, and B, maybe at risk of a derating?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. Now, in general, maybe one could consider, the U.S. market expensive, but this sector, the healthcare sector, the biotech sector, is actually not very expensive if you look at that subsector compared to the broader market, for reasons that are related to, the political debate in the U.S. regarding high drug prices and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the specific answer to your question related to the biotech sector. But there are also like more broader answers. I don't know if you recently saw Warren Buffett say that, the U.S. market isn't actually that expensive. It's actually very cheap because the interest rates are so low and they're probably going to stay low for a long time. So I don't know, there are various views about, the price of the market,
Yeah. Okay. I suppose another issue, with so much invested in the US, I mean, what effect do currency fluctuation have on international biotechnology trusts' returns?
Oh, yeah, that's very important. I will answer this, with two answers. One is that we don't hedge the currency. So an investor in the trust would be exposed to the currency of the underlying investment. So 87% is US dollars, right? And then the rest is European currencies, euros and others. So that's one thing to consider. But the second thing is that you actually invested in an international industry. So even if, you have a US investment in a company, that company, like Vertex, for example, that sells a drug for cystic fibrosis, it sells that drug in the whole world. So it will be exposed to sales in euro, in yen, and in dollars. And it really, from that point of view, really doesn't matter where it's listed if it is a drug with global sales.
Okay. So what are the main risks to your investments at present?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question regarding risk. We spend a lot of time on risk, and we try to reduce the risk as much as possible. There are, market risks. We can't do very much about that. But the specific risk within this sector, we can really think about. And we run a pretty, traditional model where we think diversification is good. So if you have a lot of investments rather than, few investments, then you reduce the company-specific risk. So I describe I have quite a few holdings, and we have no holding is very big. So in that way, we can reduce the risk of having one company or one investment being, you know, very big, and then something happens. There could be a big move in the portfolio. Also, we SV Health Investors are only doing healthcare investments, so we don't do anything else. And we're specialists in healthcare. We have 70 people working with the investments in healthcare, all coming from the industry with a medical background or industrial background. So if you know what you're investing in, you reduce the risk of doing something wrong. You know what you invest in. So kind of the board that decided that SV Health Investors should manage this trust decided that it's good that somebody that knows about healthcare does this. And then within the various companies, there is also company-specific risk in the sense that something can go wrong. A clinical trial can fail, or something can go wrong. You can lose a lot of money. I don't know if you remember AstraZeneca 2 years ago had this Mystic trial that failed in the summer, and then stock was down 10%. Now, that was a big company. Small company can have much bigger moves. So what we do in that respect to reduce that risk is to not to invest in these companies at the time when they have this exposure to a clinical trial. So let's say a year from now, company A would have a phase 3 results from a very important trial, then we would not be invested 1 year from now in that stock. But right now we could invest, for the next 9 months. It's relatively unrisky. So we follow the news of every company, one or two major value drivers, to see when in time is there a risk, and then we kind of trade out of the names into that risk. So that's a couple of factors that we think about. But it is a sector with a higher beta than the general stock market. So with beta, it means it has a higher volatility. So when the stock market is down, usually biotech is down a little bit more, stock market is up, it's up a little bit more. So that is also a risk that you have to consider as an investor, I think.
Okay. Now, you invest in a growth-oriented sector, but in 2016, amended the trust policy so you could pay dividends from capital reserves equivalent to 4% of your net asset value at the end of a preceding financial year. Why did you decide to do this?
That's a very good question, very interesting question. To start with, I actually was negative to doing that, but then our investors wanted us to do it, and it's kind of the way also I think the market has evolved, that some growth trusts actually pay a dividend. So we decided in 16 to pay, as you said, 4% of net asset value, and immediately I found out that there were new investors that were interested. Usually we would only have growth investors, meaning investors that don't think about having an income. Now suddenly income investors would be very interested, like endowment funds or people that want to have an income, like a dividend. And we had broadened out the investor base, actually. And some of these investors tell me that they're happy that they can invest in this growth sector now with a dividend. So the dividend, I think, is it was considered sustainable in the sense that it's paid out of capital gains, as you mentioned. And going forward into the future, thinking about history, biotech sector has grown by 10% per year, I mentioned in the beginning of the interview. Now, if that would repeat itself in the future, and then you pay 4% in dividend, you still have 6% capital gains. So I think the model gives an investor the opportunity to have both capital gains and a dividend, and I don't think it's a bad thing.
Okay, but doesn't it force you to sell holdings that perhaps could have gone on to deliver strong growth? And I mean, has it impaired the growth returns of the trust?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and it addresses, how do we actually manage the trust? How active are we? I mean, your question kind of implies that you buy stock and keep it forever and don't do very much. Now, that is actually not the case. The turnover of the trust is more than 100% per year. So we actually buy and sell a lot of these stocks, and we also can gear the trust up to 15%. We have a borrowing facility of 15%, and the prospectus says that we can borrow up to 30%. So anyway, on a given day, if you want to pay a dividend, there is this gearing facility that you could use, or we could just sell a few shares in a company that we maybe want to sell out for for reasons of the binary event risk, or they all could also be companies that have been acquired. You know, every year there are M&A transactions in this sector where especially the mid caps are acquired by large caps. You know, you had Glaxo buying Tesserow in the fall, and we own Tesserow, so that would generate cash also. So there is always a turnover in the trust, and a 4% dividend that's paid twice a year as 2% in January and 2% in August doesn't create any problem of the sort that you mentioned in your question.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the trust had recently was recently trading, or it is trading at a slight premium, but obviously it used to trade at times quite a wide discount. Is the move to a premium because of the change in the income policy?
Good, you spotted that. I started to be a fund manager here. I'm the lead fund manager. I started in September 13. So when we decided to do this income policy in September 16, I had as a new manager generated 3-year performance, and 3 years kind of, you know, the holy grail of what you need to do before anyone believes that you can do a good thing, and that was good. We have outperformed versus our benchmark, and then we had also at the same time this dividend policy introduced, and we had some changes on the unquoted side doing a venture fund. So I think all these things together made the trust, you know, more interesting and for an investor. Maybe you know, the combination of income and good performance was a good mix there at that time. And since then, discount has narrowed, yes.
Okay, thank you, Carl. A really interesting update on International Biotechnology Trust and the prospects for biotechnology shares.
Thank you very much, Lenora.
Retirees and investors who draw regular income from their investments often focus on UK equity income. But if too much of your income comes from a small number of holdings, you could be at risk in a fall in it if one of the holdings fails to pay dividends. Zayani, you've been looking at this. What can investors do to mitigate this risk?
Hi, Leonora. So, yeah, one thing that investors can do is invest in equity income funds outside the UK. And Asian equity income funds are a particularly good solution. There are several reasons for this. Firstly, the region's predominantly young population is getting richer. Economies that used to be dominated by commodities and export manufacturing are now diversifying. And finally, increasing numbers of Asian companies are now paying dividends and have the resources to support the wider growth.
Okay, so how can investors get access to these Asian companies?
So one good way to access such companies is through the Guinness Asian Equity Income Fund. The fund is managed by Edmund Harris and Mark Hammonds and has been since it started in 2013. The fund typically invests in about 30 to 40 companies, and half of its assets are in financial or IT companies. The managers have a very strict one-in, one-out policy when they're picking new funds, so any new ones have to be better than existing ones. But they also invest in Singapore and Australia.
Now, you said they've got quite a strict investment policy, so you know, how do we go about choosing the companies?
So the managers screen for companies that fulfil three criteria. The first is that they must generate capital growth that is above the cost of capital. The second is that they must be able to sustainably grow their dividends and not just have a high dividend yield. And the final is that they must have a proven track record of being able to weather different economic environments over time. So a good example of a company that they invest in is China Lilang, which is a fashion retailer, and it's also their largest holding.
Okay. And has their approach worked well?
Yeah, this approach has worked really well for them, actually. They have an attractive yield of nearly 4%. In most years, the fund has outperformed its benchmark. It's also beaten the MSCI AC Asian Pacific X Japan Index and the Investment Association Asia Pacific X Japan Sector Average over 1, 3, and 5 years.
Okay. Now, I mean, this all sounds really good, but there's always two sides, aren't there?
Yeah.
So, you know, are there any downsides or risks to investing in Asian equity income?
Yeah, the main one is that the fund can be quite volatile because it invests in emerging market companies. The fund's investments could also be at risk if there's a slowdown in China, in the Chinese economy, as it changes from export-led to more consumer-led. And obviously, as it's an equity income fund, there's the risk of the company not being able to pay its dividends.
Thank you, Zayani. Some really useful points. That brings us to the end of today's show. But see this week's issue of a website for Zayani's full report on Guinness Asian Equity Income Fund and more on healthcare and biotech funds and investing for income. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.